Well, welcome, everybody. This is Dave. How are you guys doing?
Doing great.
Super. We have one additional professional who has joined us, and I would like her to introduce herself. Is Lelia here? Lelia's not here. Is Amy here? Okay, I'll double-check and see what's happening. I had a note that Tisha is traveling and won't be with us today. So let's begin with an update, and I'm interested to hear your impressions as you've had a chance to reflect on our first session and maybe begin some of the reading. What kind of thoughts and reflections do you have about our beginning experience?
I'll start. This is Terry.
Please.
I loved the reading. Loved it. Took like several hours and just focused on it, did nothing else. Loved the content and was really appreciative of kind of the steps in how to break down writing your own story, because I had started to write my story after our first call.
Uh-huh.
And it was a lot more difficult than I had thought. So the first module was really helpful, I think, in breaking that down.
Okay. Well, good. It's awfully hard to really tell our stories to ourselves in order to know exactly how to think about it, how to assess it, how to change it. So I'm interested if this process for each of you is useful, and if there are ways that you think it might be applicable to working with clients to really think about deconstructing a story, hearing a story, and then being able to work with someone to look at elements that they want to change, to revise, or to write a different story. So thanks for that feedback. That's good to hear. Other thoughts and other reactions? Or just any updates?
Hello.
From any of you. Yes.
Hello, Dave. This is Lalia Helmer calling. I was not on your very first call because I signed up for the class.
Yes, exactly.
I had
asked for you at the beginning of this session, and welcome. Would you introduce yourself and give us an idea of your background and your journey to coaching, and especially what you'd like to get out of our collaboration together?
But because I was in such a rush in a way, because I signed up, like I said, after you had already begun, and then I got the email to send my bio and so on. So I just quickly lifted something off of something that I had done, and then I saw everybody else's great bios where they really talked about who they were and what they loved to do and so on. And there's a common theme here, because I also started out as a dancer way back. I was going to be a modern dancer, you know, working with some famous, presumably with some famous dance companies, but then went into actually dance therapy because I really loved kind of dealing with the mental side of people and combining it with their bodies. And then continued sort of to do that, and then went into organizational psychology, got a degree in that, and have been doing some teaching psychology in undergraduate courses, and or doing some consulting to companies and team building, and primarily career coaching. But I wanted to kind of expand my coaching perspective on things. So that's why this was intriguing, because I find that it is all about people's stories. So that's why I'm here.
And what
do you want
to do with this training? What do you envision in terms of your practice or your work?
I'm in my own story with what I want to do, and I'm having some thoughts on perhaps creating an organization that has as part of kind of a host of variety of types of workshops that are available to people. And so that's one thought that I was thinking in terms of using this. And then just in general, just in my own coaching, I'm always interested in finding new ways and approaches that work for people. So, yeah.
Okay. All right. Terrific. Welcome. It's great to have you.
Okay. Thank you.
And there is a recording of each session that's posted usually by noon the next day at the page where you downloaded the outline and the syllabus and that sort of thing. So that,
yeah, I heard the first one. I listened to it avidly.
Okay.
Okay.
Right,
thank
great.
You.
Good. Other updates. Or any other questions or challenges? As I mentioned before, I want to save a bit of time at the beginning and the end for discussion of the material, for things that are of interest to you, and particularly to look at any of your cases or challenging situations that we can apply this material and look at doing that kind of case illustration, since we don't do a formal coach-the-coach. So anything that you'd like to bring for us to look at or discuss as a group, that'll be great. So other thoughts, questions, challenges?
Hey, Dave, this is Jen Powers.
Hey, welcome.
How are you? I'm at a family reunion down in California, so I might be more muted than I'd like to be today, and so I just wanted to let you know that.
Okay,
but I was able to see the way.
I'm glad you could join us, Phil. Great.
Thank you. Okay.
Super. What else? Other areas you'd like to discuss or things that have come up in the reading or in your own work and coaching yourself or your clients that would be? Yes.
Dave, this is Terry Holmes.
Please.
And it was really interesting as I was reading through my background and most of my coaching has and most of my education is I'm a very self-educated person. And I found when I was going through this that I really discovered I have some real issues around. My mother has a PhD. My sister has a PhD. And I really have some real issues and stories around coaching and my ability to be successful without those letters behind my name. And it was just a really interesting, you know, story that I have around that. So that it was just as I was going through this process, realizing that I really do have that story.
Uh-huh. What are your thoughts at this point about how you'll address that?
You know, I'm not sure at this point. I go through an inquiry process and regarding the reality of it or not, and I'm not sure.
I'll tell you my experience as having practiced psychiatry, psychoanalysis, therapy, and analysis basically for 25 years. I see coaching being even more efficient and effective in so many ways that I think that what you'll find is when you really incorporate the skills and the abilities, including integrating the psychology, the neuroscience, the quantum physics of these experiences along with strategic coaching and applied in strategic coaching, that you're going to be much more effective in helping people change, in looking at mind, brain, and behavior changes that last than any kind of degrees that you may have. I've trained a number of people, a good number of people, who have all kinds of degrees who have found this approach and integrating those disciplines into strategic coaching can be significantly more effective. Now, you'll have, and I think you're very savvy to be looking at this because you'll have to work on your story. Because what? Let me give you guys a quiz. There were several thousand professionals who were surveyed by the Wharton School of Business. They surveyed the group. They looked at a broad number of possibilities. They cast a broad net to look at what are the factors that determine whether someone sign on for professional services or decline professional services. And what they found was far and away there was one factor that determined whether someone signed on for professional services. Now, here's the multiple choice quiz. Was it amount of fee, state of the economy, credentials and certifications, reputation, number of years of experience doing what they were doing professionally? What do you think it was? The number one factor, far and away. Terry H., what's your guess?
I
have a buzzer here if you say credentials. That's just a hint. Okay.
That would be my guess.
I'm sorry?
That would be my guess. I don't know if that's correct.
Okay. I'm gonna sound my annoying buzzer now, okay, because you were warned. Okay. All right. That's a very good guess. Other guesses? Anyone else? Take a chance. What's your guess?
Like age and experience.
Oh, okay. All right. That's a great guess. Other guesses?
This is Terry Finney. I would say reputation. Actually, I would say none of the above, but given those, I would say reputation.
All right. Wait. Now, I think that's a really, really interesting answer because you're not bound by thinking within the box. What's your none of the above answer?
It would have to do with, I think, the connection or the conversation that occurs between the person and the person they're thinking about working with.
And I would have to agree. I mean, if given those choices, that would have been, this is Terry H., would have been my choice. I really believe it's probably more personal connection.
Okay. I think that's a great answer. The answer is none of the above. What they found that surpassing all of those in combination was that the professional stated the recommendation and the fee especially clearly and confidently. That the confidence, the state of mind of confidence was far and away the most important factor whether someone signed on or if it was said with less confidence if they did not. And we know from the neuroscience and neuromarketing that people don't buy an item or a service. They buy a state of mind. And the people who are able to change a state of mind are the best salespeople. And think about in parenting. What do you do? What's the best thing you can possibly give your child? Is a belief in himself or herself. And that's the best thing we can do for a client. The most important thing that I do with a client is to believe in a client. That's why I don't work with anyone in whom I don't believe, because I know if I fully believe in that person, they're going to teach me why, they're going to teach both of us why. And that confidence is something that's conveyed midbrain to midbrain, mirror neuron to mirror neuron, and that's something that somebody lives into. So that's so important. And that clarity of stating it instills confidence and trust, and the confidence instills the belief that someone is going to be of help, and then they live into that together and figure out a way to do that. So that's far more important than credentials. In fact, one of the common mistakes people make in pricing their services is to price their services based on where they are, and whether you live in Runnels County, Texas, or Upper East Side of New York City should not make a difference because you can work by telephone. Waiting until you're certified, waiting until you have certain credentials, waiting until you're full, waiting until you have a bestseller. All of these are very common, pricing it based on what other coaches charge because most charge too little. All of these are very common mistakes, and that's why I want to address that with that excellent question. And I appreciate you sharing that because you sharing that aspect of your story helps us look at something that is a storyline that may not necessarily be altogether conscious, but in looking at it and talking about it, you crystallized it. So now that you have a purchase on it, you can do something about it and see if it works, and if it doesn't, see how you want to revise it. And that's exactly why these conversations are totally confidential, so that we can have the kind of discussions that are needed. So thanks very much, Terry H., for sharing that. Any other thoughts or things to talk about before we move into the material today? Okay, well, I'll ask you to manage the background noise so that we can keep an open line. And if there are, again, any questions or things as we move through the material, don't hesitate to interrupt me. Now, we discussed the power of story and the concept of writing a new story, life and others. Now we're going to look closely at how to do that, at the principles and practice of change step by step. Now, these steps are simple, but not that easy necessarily. The actual implementation of the ideas can be difficult because it often requires us to change the way we think about our lives, such as breaking bad or outdated habits, even just simply departing a comfort zone, developing new ideas or ways to do things, the discomfort of the unknown, and remaining disciplined over the long haul. So in this seminar, we're going to look at the first three steps in the roadmap process to create a new story. Recognize authorship, own your story, assess the plot and storylines. And now this is covered in Module 1, but as I mentioned, I'm not going to reiterate the things in Module 1, but Module 1 is about the first three steps. So first, you're aware of how computers have operating systems. Written within the software, within the hardware and comprising the programs is a complex system of software that contains instructions, protocols, and couplings that enable the system to function smoothly. Now, your life story has an internal operating system with a set of beliefs and assumptions about your behaviors, behavior patterns, attachment patterns, all kinds of complexities. We're about to deconstruct that system in order to study it, understand it, for you to decide where it needs editing, updating, or rewriting. So step one, recognize authorship of your life story. Now, remember the premise. Every moment we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Each is a choice. Every day begins a fresh page. The dramas of everyday life don't simply affect us, they're created by us. Yet, so often the story closest to us, our own, is the most difficult to know. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past, to end an old story, are important, but they're not enough. You have to create a new or at least revised story. So, how do we tell our stories to ourselves to know what to keep and what to change? Now, your clients probably recognize that they author their own stories. But as you listen, you'll hear a belief or an assumption that ghostwrites a storyline that may be limiting that they just take for granted. I'll give you an example in a minute of an elephant who's an elephant in every way except for one little belief. Now, there are four principles I think are important in recognizing authorship. Principle one, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. Now, all of these are in the annotated outline that you have and hopefully printed, so you don't have to do a bunch of writing. You just kind of listen and see if this makes sense to you and is useful. Beliefs are what we consider our basic truths that determine our experiences and our results in life. Our beliefs write the software of our behavior. So if you want to find out what somebody really believes, you can simply ask, yeah, but how do you know that? And then they'll tell you what their belief is. Here's an example. A baby elephant can be trained from birth to be confined to a very small space. The trainer ties a rope around its leg and stakes the rope in the ground. The baby elephant will initially try to break the rope, but the rope is strong and it can't. The baby elephant has to stay in the area then, determined by the length of the rope. When this elephant grows to a mammoth adult size, it could easily break the rope, but it doesn't, because earlier, as a baby, it couldn't. This 6-ton adult elephant is constrained by his assumption based on an earlier experience. Putting a little rope around one leg activates a belief system that then determines his behavior. Beliefs cue behaviors. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue to have the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. Principle 2. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. Our beliefs become our reality. Something you even have to believe in order to see. Our possibilities are always a manifestation of what we allow ourselves to consider. The beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception about what surrounds us, including what and how we select, register, and then process. We construct our storylines from these premises. So we have to bring our beliefs into conscious focus to allow and to access them, so that just simply so that we can assess whether they work or not. And we don't get what we want, we get what we expect. We always make our beliefs come true. If you believe, for example, that no one will love you, you will probably interpret behavior and perceive responses in that way, and act so that you may not be lovable or will block someone from really experiencing intimacy with you. You act in such a way to teach people how to respond to you. This actualizes your beliefs and validates your assumptions. Also, select carefully the people you spend time with. We're told that you're the average of 5 people you're around the most. When we get to the wellness module and seminar, there's some amazing research about this and about the contagion effect that we'll talk about. So, choose your friends and colleagues well. It makes a difference. Principle 3, a new story can only occur by living in the present moment. This is one principle that distinguishes coaching. Focus on the now and next. For example, social scientists have found that when you measure people's intentions, you affect their behavior. When people are asked what they intend to do, they're more likely to act according to how they answer. For example, when you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of their voting by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, "Do you intend to buy a new car?" This question increased purchase rates over a 6-month time compared to a control group by 35%. Other behaviors with increased frequency: asking if people intend to eat certain foods, to diet, to exercise, to save for retirement. Remember, in the basic coaching model, the final step of each session is to frame an action plan for the next week that the client intends, commits to do. Principle 4, our minds seek closure and infer causality, accurate or not. A number of research findings illustrate that we find something to make sense of what we perceive, even if it's not cause and effect. These research findings suggest that people can be unaware of the reasons that they do what they do, but when asked for a reason, readily give one. And this is an amplification of that quiz, the study that I'm about to tell you, because it's how our minds work to bring closure to something that we perceive at an intuitive level and make it make sense in some way. In fact, neuroscientists have suggested that the primary purpose of our frontal lobes, our prefrontal cortex, is to find things that make sense of what we've already decided at the midbrain level. Now, a series of studies was done by Dr. Dan Gilbert at Harvard. He showed volunteers words flashed on a computer screen for a few milliseconds. It was actually 1/50th of a second, so this was subliminal programming. This was such a short time that they were unaware that the words were shown. They couldn't even pick them out or guess from a multiple choice, yet they were influenced by them. For example, when the word hostile was flashed, volunteers would judge others somewhat more negatively. When the word elderly was flashed, volunteers would walk a bit more slowly. When the word stupid was flashed, volunteers would perform less well on tests. And this subliminal programming lasted somewhere between 40 and 55 minutes after the word was flashed. Now, when these volunteers were later asked why they judged or walked or scored the way they did, they didn't know, and we know they didn't know. They couldn't even pick out the words on a multiple choice. But yet, they didn't say, I don't know. They made some reason that made it make sense. For example, whenever it was pointed out that they walked a bit more slowly, at first they denied it. They did not think this was true. And when they were showed evidence of it and asked, why do you think that was, they said, well, I was a little bit tired, or I've been jet-lagged, or I haven't been sleeping that well. When they were told that it was a subliminal influence of a word, they said, no, that's not true. I'm not fooled by stuff like that. It's just because I was tired. So they didn't even believe it. Our minds and our brains seek closure. Our minds seek a closure in order to create an end of a story, a cause and effect. Our brains seek closure to end dissonance. To create a complete story infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness. So complete even trumps accurate. This is why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other mental gymnastics that bring closure without ownership or growth, kind of like a finish without an ending. And again, if there are any thoughts or questions, don't hesitate to interrupt me. And think about how this is an application of an understanding of why the recommendation and the statement of fee clearly and confidently would make a big difference, because it brings a sense of trust, it brings a sense of closure, and that was more important than, far and away more important than the amount of the fee even. I want to highlight a couple of things just to review. The exercise in step one, recognize authorship of your story. It's on page 1.9. And notice that the self-quizzes focus on some major areas: needs, ideals, relationships, career, identity. Here's an example of someone recognizing authorship of a story, because this sounds maybe a little bit elusive, that somebody is going to recognize that they're writing their own story. It's much more common than it may look at first glance. A woman wrote me after reading my book, Destiny, An Uncommon Journey. It's an allegory of self-development with Destiny, the ship undergoing transformation inside and outside. She said, you know, that could be a profile of my life. I'm sure a lot of other people experience the same thing. I don't want to relive this pattern over and over again. There seems to be this circuitry I keep entering. Destiny had to trust in order to learn. When will I learn to trust? I keep peeling back more layers. How many layers to these distortions are there? She elaborated how frustrating therapy had been for several years with several different therapists. And I wrote back the following response. You'll recognize this here. We each have a personal story with a plot and storylines. Our beliefs ghostwrite that story. When you peel back all the layers of the onion, what's left is not a pure, unadulterated onion, but nothing, since you've destroyed the object of the quest. Instead of the model of layers going deeper to discover the next layer, consider generating a new story, going forward rather than backward, possibilities rather than problems. You can even assess when you're rewriting an old story and plagiarizing an earlier version of yourself. Then you can edit the repeating storyline or create a new one. She decided from that response to work together in coaching for a few months to create a new story. She now writes stories for a major U.S. publication and is working on a second screenplay. She asked me, when we stopped, if I would be in the audience when she was nominated for an Academy Award. Step two, own your story. And here I want to emphasize the exercise, especially assumptions and motivations constructing storylines. It's on page 113 in the owner's guide. So basically, from an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see, and then, once input, how we process it. It's our software package. Adding more information to the millions of bits of data that we process daily, like a new diet, a health club membership, is likely not going to have an impact unless you change the software. A common example, 95% of people who diet gain back their weight and often add 1% to 2%. Now, what's the reason? The primary reason is they don't change their software. They don't change their core identity. When they don't change the software, their body moves back to the form that fits their internal software. And this is a précis of the P of the roadmap, program new identity, because the most fundamental force of the human psyche is that we always move back to our identity. You can have a behavior change, you can do something different, but unless that's incorporated in an evolving way to transform the model that you operate on, the who and the how you are, your sense of identity, then it's going to revert back to that core identity. And that's why I think it's so important that we help someone evolve the model that they're operating on along with the changes that they're going through. And we're gonna talk some more about that because I think it's so very important. So as we examine how a storyline is constructed, here's an equation that I think will be helpful. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. So in other words, if someone has a performance that they're not really happy with or that's not productive or has a glass ceiling, then look at the antecedent, look at the specific behavior that is generating that performance to look at what may need to be changed or revised. If the behavior is not adequate or efficient or optimal, then look at the antecedent there, at the belief. What's the belief that's driving the behavior? So this will help you look at where you want to intervene in helping someone look at their story. So a couple of examples of empowering beliefs. I can make the money I need. I'll find a way to love my work. Limiting beliefs can influence reality and behavior. They have an effect emotionally and physically. A couple of examples. And any time I hear any one of these, it's a coachable moment. That's why I request the rule of engagement to be able to interrupt at any time. I just can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. My opinion doesn't matter. I can't seem to find a way to save for the future. The way you figure out or how you adapt or survive is usually the way you continue to do that. Your first survival strategy then usually becomes a favorite. But favorite even implies a choice. So first you have to experience everything you do as a choice rather than just the way things are. Now, notice how the examples I gave are a variety of responses, behaviors, reactions, even complex patterns. And we're in a unique position as coaches to observe patterns. The brain seeks patterns. Metaphors and narratives become brain structures. One example is attachment patterns. There's been a great deal of study of how attachment patterns beginning from infant and parent are laid down early on and then continued. And I want to give you an illustration of this because you're going to see various kinds of attachment patterns with your clients. they're going to show you exactly what it's like to be them, and that's their job description. And the attachment pattern they have that may be the need for coaching will be something that comes alive in the work with you. Let me give you an example of what I mean by this. And think about the human equivalents. I recently raised a hatching of wild ducks, mallards, in a pen that I constructed at my ranch. Now, the pen was necessary to protect them from critters until they're old enough to fend for themselves and flee danger by flying, especially since I'm there only on weekends. It was a huge pen. It was like 6 feet by 4 feet by 3 feet. But this necessitated living in the pen partly submerged in the water at the edge of the lake so they could learn to swim and develop naturally for about 5 weeks. When I finally opened the gate of the pen, they wouldn't leave. Despite their freedom to swim in one of a couple of beautiful lakes or just fly away, confinement in a small pen had become a comfort zone. I had to force them out, actually pick up the pen and dump them out. Then, as soon as they were released, all 12 moved as a group, never more than a few inches apart, a habit they formed in the pen. They continued to fly and swim in that really tight pattern for a long, long time. Now, think about your attachment patterns, the default behaviors of your relationships with important people. Some may have been etched early on with essential people in your life. Even though it's a default mode, even though you've incorporated it as a model, perhaps even use it with children or partner, it's still a choice. You can choose to continue or choose another pattern, another habit. Just because you have a history with someone doesn't mean you have to keep repeating it. Now, here's an example. I was working with the CEO of a successful company that he founded. His son had a condition that if he took medication, he could remain without symptoms. He had bipolar disorder. But his son would not take his medication. His son was a PhD, and he was, I think, 32 at the time. But he had been hospitalized since this first developed in his early 20s. He'd been hospitalized 6 different times. And these were lengthy marathons of several months each. And each time, my client would fly to the city where his son was, take an apartment, and help him through the whole rehab process. And my client's health and his business suffered during each of these times. And he was about to repeat this pattern he had engaged in when his son was in crisis. His son was about to be hospitalized, and my client was naturally going to fall into the same habit and go and rescue him. He had orchestrated the equivalent of 6 midnight helicopter rescues from a Mexican prison. I mean, he had really put a lot of himself into this. Now, I needed to respond to him as one of my hats as a mentor coach is a Dutch uncle. And I asked him if it had really made a difference in his son's life each of these 6 times that he was there and helped him through the crisis. And he acknowledged that it didn't, that it made absolutely no difference, especially in his son getting back on his medication, doing the things that he needed to do in his life. And he was enhancing his own sense of helplessness that by had now affected his health in some significant ways and running his company. We looked at focusing on what he could determine and what he couldn't determine. He needed to stop rescuing. Part of what we did in coaching was that I recommended that he and his wife attend CODA meetings for support for people who have loved ones who will not take care of themselves, and recommended specifically that he not rescue his son, that he respect the dignity of his son's ability to take care of himself, use his own resources, and really walk alone this time with the professionals that he was having. So this was something that I recommended that was very counterintuitive for him. And we spent 2 or 3 sessions during this time just on this for him, because it was awfully, he was one of the best dads I know, but his particular attachment pattern to his son had not perpetuated the problem, but had been totally ineffective and added to the behavior of his son. So my client let go. And it was one of the toughest things he did. He and his wife both went to CODA, and they looked at this in a totally different way. At this point, this is 3 years later, almost 4 years later, his son is now taking meds consistently for the first time in his adult life. He has a faculty position. He's married and started a family, and he has been, for almost 4 years, totally committed to taking his medications and not doing a relapse again. Now, there's a lot more detail there, but that's the highlight of how necessary it was to respond to his son as an adult who needed to take his own story in his own hands rather than continuing to perpetuate a variation of a childhood story. So a fundamental precept then of step two, own your story. Whatever you experience in adulthood, you either create or accept. Now, let's apply that notion by talking about first point of reference. Point of reference is a pretty basic component of story writing. People who don't own their stories have a premise of an external point of reference. And this theme can include passivity or resignation. Their experience is often helplessness. They transfer responsibility to someone or something outside themselves. They react to situations they're in. So here are some characteristics of those with an external point of reference. They feel as if they have little or no control over things. Life is just happening to be reacted to. Well, there's nothing I can do. They're vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They focus on responding rather than creating. Well, I have to do this. They see themselves as unchanging. Well, that's just the way I am. They believe that they can only change things by changing the outside source or person. And an additional aspect that could be one of the qualities, some of which I've mentioned here, when they experience a symptom in their bodies, they medicate it away. That's like seeing a warning light on the dash of your car and turning off the connection rather than really pursuing the problem. Now, contrast that. Those with an internal point of reference see their authority as their own. So everything, any mention of any one of the things that I just illustrated, to me is a coachable moment. And this is what we're coaching toward. People know that they write their own stories. And here are some of the characteristics. They recognize accountability for their own lives. They are proactive. They plan. They look around the corner. When experiencing an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated the result. Then they also look for alternatives. When they see a result that doesn't work, they decide not to continue. They decide what to change and to initiate that change. They also recognize that the menu of choices is created. You can choose, and you can choose how you choose. Now, a related notion is to recognize active versus passive position. I'm mentioning some of these things not only because they're important in story construction, but I think by really listening carefully that you can get more data from someone over the telephone by listening carefully than you can face-to-face. Even though you give up the visual cues, you develop other sources of information even more exquisitely, in my view. Sometimes the story seems to write itself, to just happen to you. So these are examples of passive positions. I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. My thoughts ran away from me. It just seems to keep happening. So you have to eliminate all the outs. Remember the anthropologist. The idea of a gun was enough to change everything. These passive positions disown the feelings, thoughts, or actions as an active creation. It's as if the feeling you create makes you its victim. My anxiety stopped me. My doubt paralyzed me. It's like the feeling that you create takes on a life of its own and then acts on you to make you its victim so that you see yourself as the victim rather than the author of the feeling. So, rather than managing, overcoming, countering, or medicating a feeling, the first step is to acknowledge, even though it seems to just happen, you generate the experience. Then you can examine the meaning you attach. Insight and understanding alone do not generate a positive, successful new story. You create it. So, once recognizing and owning your story, steps one and two, step three, assess the storylines and plot. Now, a belief or a fact is an anatomical reality in the brain. We did not learn that in high school. I didn't even learn that in medical school. Whenever you have a belief or know a fact, it's a physical part of a neuronal network. And a teacher, for example, can't simply present an explanation and remove an existing neural network from a student's brain. You can't just list the three reasons that an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange a neural network and neural pathways. Same in coaching. Presenting a new fact, a new way of doing something, a recommendation is not going to overwrite what's already there. But change can occur as a process, not necessarily as an event. And it's an inside job. So this step, assessing the storylines and plot, is to assess to see if beliefs are limiting and then to try out other beliefs to see if the enactments are effective or not. What's another way of looking at this? How might my thoughts be limiting me? Who has a different perspective on this? Are there questions I'm afraid to ask? And at some level, you know exactly what they are, because remember, denial is a powerful engagement. So is a secret. What do I really want? What do I need to let go of? Now, I want to highlight a couple of exercises in the workbook, beginning on page 1.17. Ideals and needs are really at the core of identity. They're part of the foundation of self. Of all of the exercises and tools, needs and ideal assessment is the one I use most with clients. And I will get from them their three most important needs and three most valued ideals and put them inside the folder that I keep on each person. So I'll have a ready reference to really have for both of us the clarity and the focus on needs and ideals so that the strategies can fit with goals and the process of how someone moves forward. So all of that fits together, so all of them is going in the same direction. Ideals are really standards of excellence. Ideals are, in essence, personal values. And in fact, the only place that I know that self-esteem comes from is from having attainable internal ideals and living up to them. And if self-esteem came from any other place, it wouldn't have that name. It comes from a sense of self and living up to ideals. Now, and the failure to live up to an ideal is the sense of shame. And we'll return to that because that's one of the most, probably the most difficult experience or feeling to deal with is the feeling of shame. And there are distinctions of gender stereotypy about how women and men experience shame in different ways. And we'll return to that because I think it's important. Also, I want to highlight the exercise on needs. A need is an essential requirement, a necessity for mind, body, or spirit. And unmet, frustrated needs create discomfort. And you can get sick if you don't have enough of a need. You can get sick if you have too much of a want. But needs are very important to recognize because they don't go away if you don't meet them. They hang around until you meet them in one form or another. Now, I want to give you a vignette from a client that illustrates work to clarify needs and ideals and to align needs and ideals with goals and strategies. And notice from this how much we can learn. I'll highlight this as we go along or as I discuss it. How much we can learn from someone's language and behaviors about the assumptions that drive their stories. The client said, I feel like I've been cheated at the end of the day. It's 9 o'clock at night, and I haven't eaten yet. The way my schedule goes is that I come home from work, my wife hands our son to me, and I'm in charge of him from 5 to 7. I love that, but I'm tired. And the son is an infant son. She uses that time to do her computer work and to catch up from her professional work during the day. Then I finish work from the day, and it's at least 9 o'clock. I'm stressed out. I highlighted two aspects of what he said. I've been cheated, and the way my schedule is, both of those passive language. But I just highlighted them to look at what he thought about it. I pointed out that he was speaking as if he were not writing his own story, as if it were being ghostwritten by someone else and not even approved by him. Now, I knew he was in charge of his own schedule. Then I asked him simply, why do you think you're writing your story each day in a way that you don't like? And he paused. He was kind of dumbfounded. He said, I've never looked at it like that. I guess I feel like I have to. I feel like I have to support my wife and take care of our son in that way. My work just spills into the evening, into my private life. So I don't work out or relax. I even have to take calls from my people during the time with my son. Something is assumed and expected of me when I walk in the door. I feel like somebody else is in control of me. And I said, what do you hear yourself saying? And he thought for a moment. He said, like somebody else is writing my story for me. I said, you're not acting like you own your story or your company. He said, well, how can I protect the time with my son? I said, every yes you have to pay for with at least one no. And those yeses are getting pretty expensive. No protected time to be totally with him, for him and you. No total immersion in play for either of you. And I said, let's start at the beginning. Assume every day is a blank page and there's nothing on it until you write it. How ideally would you like your day to be? And he went through that and looked at it in a very different way and constructed his day. He constructed his day. He owned a very successful company. And instead of just responding and reacting to people, he started by constructing every element of his day. And then he got to the time after work. He said, I'd like to use that time after work for my family and to relax. He then constructed a time in which he was in charge of his schedule at home, in which he proactively decided the boundaries, the parameters, the structure. He even worked in at my nudging exercise. I said, I hear you beginning to write a different story, to really take care of yourself. It's also a powerful model for your son, for him to see fully how a man can take care of himself and others. When he was really getting it, and reflecting on what we were doing and the importance of it personally and professionally, I decided to add a dimension here because I thought he was insightful and introspective enough, and I'd heard derivatives of this from time to time. He said, I want to share a hunch to see if it's useful for us to consider. I suspect the frustrations that you haven't spoken until now about your company, your marriage, are there at a subliminal level and get communicated so that others feel it. Your wife, your employees, your customers. I guess it registers as maybe something not working quite right. And you or they don't know exactly why until it lights on something that makes sense, even though it may not be the real cause. And he immediately said, yeah, like when I blow up or fire somebody. I said, that would end the tension for a little while. He said, yeah, but then I'm off for the races again. And he recognized that if he structured a way to meet his own needs, to take care of the foundation of his wellness, that he was creating a personal and professional mastery. by having those clear boundaries, he could be totally immersed in work during the day and totally free at home. And both were very restorative for him. Now, part of the assessment of your life story is to understand conflicted and contradictory storylines. When you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map. A paradigm, also called a mindset, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. So the paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. With the right map, planning and strategy can make a huge difference. And we each have a number of maps or paradigms in our heads, storylines. There's been some recent research that has shown that this is exactly how our minds work. Like a Google map, we have a concept or an idea, and we boot up a map, like Google boots up a map, and we use that. So if we look at each of these as paradigms, as mindsets or mind maps, then we look at what is the continuity from map to map. What is the story that unites these? For example, if you read the anxiety or uncertainty of a new experience in an old paradigm, such as anxiety equals danger ahead or uncertainty means wrong decision, it makes sense to stop. Now, to use a current paradigm, a correct paradigm might be to reframe that uncertainty and excitement and trepidation as a natural experience, expectable in moving ahead in new territory, to reframe it as a signpost of progress, as validation that you're moving ahead. So it makes a lot of difference to use the correct map. Another example, we need to be afraid of the right thing. What we fear is usually what's easily remembered and what's more emotionally available and what's more recent because it's more charged, the recency effect. And we fear what we can't control as well. It's far more dangerous statistically to be behind the wheel of a car, but in airplane seat 18C, we have no control. Somebody else is at the helm. An example. Smokers who are afraid of flying. Averaged across all participants, smoking shortens their lives by 5 years. Averaged across all participants, flying shortens their lives by 1 day. Another just brief example. People fear someone entering their homes and committing a violent crime more than food entering their body that clogs arteries and causes heart attacks. So one of the unique qualities we have as human beings is self-awareness. The ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. This means that we can learn from our experiences and from others' experiences as well. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. And this is another coachable moment. If someone defines themselves, their identity, by their collection of repetitions, their habits. We can think these things about these things and reflect on them, examine our paradigms, see which ones serve us well and which don't, and change. We can see which repeated experiences work and don't, and elect to do exactly what we want. So one thing that's really important is to listen to your self-statements. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. Whatever you attribute to others, another person, a group, a culture, comes from inside you as a self-statement. We always perceive and create outside to match inside. So pay attention to what you consistently like and dislike in another. Don't project your intentions onto someone else's behavior. Acknowledge and own everything about yourself. Take yourself very personally. Listen carefully and explicitly to all the messages from your interior, to your whole truth. Feelings never lie. The body cannot deceive. So if you want to find out what you believe about yourself and the world, look around at your life. It's the self-statement, the mirror of what exists inside you. When you feel preoccupied or disrupted internally, you'll notice that your house or office or car reflects that experience. All that you say in the syntax of thought, feeling, and behavior is about yourself. Remember, too, everyone else is also making self-statements. What you say about me doesn't tell me about me, it tells me about you. When someone says what someone says about you, has everything to do with the speaker, even though it's focused on you. Now, I would say listen, take in new information, but as coaches, especially, don't take it personally. Now, only a theory is ever as simple and clear as this, but all someone else can do is share their experience of you. It's their experience and perception, their point of view. You can share your own experience of someone else, but be aware that your perception is also filtered through your own lens. For example, if someone's being critical and judgmental of you, it's your decision whether to believe and accept that point of view. Consider if you're assigning an aspect of yourself to someone else. If you believe you lack a certain quality, you may focus on someone who exhibits it. This reliance on someone functioning for you and on an external point of reference for validation can be limiting. So, in order to grow, you have to move your point of reference to an internal one, to own responsibility for all the expressions of your life. Now, one other aspect I want to touch on before we stop for discussion is to listen for repetitions of the old story. We each generate a life story with a recurring plot. We repeat its continuing formula over time, even when it's not a winning one. Each repetition may more deeply reinforce basic assumptions and a belief that you're a victim of fate. And remember this, whatever remains unconscious is likely to be attributed to fate. To re-enter an old story and attempt to write a better ending creates a variation of this scenario, but it's a new edition of the same process. And anytime you re-enter an old story to write a better ending, you etch it further in your brain. And that's how people can get stuck in therapy. The more you run away from something, the more you engage it. So the more apparent it becomes. And sometimes you can only recognize something the first time by denying it. But denial is another form of engagement. At times, we repeat just to see, in relation to a fixed point of reference, how much we've changed. Each time we return to the chorus of a song, the repetition is satisfying, but those same words are different, for more of the lyrical story has unfolded, and we see more of the evolving journey at each juncture of repetition. You probably had the experience to go back to somewhere, in something in your past, like a high school auditorium, and a place that seemed like, well, the whole world was in there, and then it seems so small now because you have a different perspective. And at that time in your life, the whole world was there. You're always reaching your goals, whether they're conscious or not. And this is important because it's useful to know consciously and specifically what those goals are. For example, if you want to change your body, begin changing your body image. Visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self, not a false body self, for example, of overweight or out of shape. Then create an informed plan to get there. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. Listen to your language in regard to your goals. If you say you're going to try to reach a goal, you may be protecting yourself from anticipated failure. Trying immediately says there's not a full commitment. It's a potential diversion to other alternatives against failure. You know the words of someone who's not committed. I'll try, I should, I ought to, I know I need to. These build in a takeaway, a detraction, by not being totally committed, by creating an out. When somebody says, I'm going to try to quit drinking, you know they're going to keep drinking. Here are the words of someone committed. I will. And as coaches, we build in accountability by asking, by when? our SMART goals wouldn't have a T on the end. And finally, listen to your body. Your body always speaks to you. This is kind of foreshadowing the wellness module. When you listen to whispers, no one has to shout. You sense it and feel it when you eat healthily, work out, and rest well, at the time and especially later. Now, we're going to return to this in Module 10, but here's the prologue. Listen to somatic language, to the message in each pain, discomfort, dis-ease, change of function, exhilaration, sensation, energy spur. There are no accidents within the system, the story of your body. As with any complex system, a change in one component affects every aspect of that system. Of the body's 11 systems, only two have memory, the nervous and the immune. A new story involving your body inscribes a new text for these two systems and benefits your entire body. Now, here's a final thought, and it's a suggestion. Schedule an appointment with yourself, in the passive version, if I find time. An appointment with yourself on two occasions. One, to meditate, and two, to brainstorm. Two different times because they're two different states of mind. And here's a suggested prompt for your brainstorm session. Everyone on Earth has one thing in common, that our choices in life define us. Those who provide service to others, such as authors, money managers, therapists, leaders, teachers, coaches, especially parents, have their answers counted many, many times. What will yours be? Make it matter. Okay, I'm interested in your thoughts and questions, your reaction to the material. I know it's a sudden transition from sort of listening passively to actively beginning to engage in discussion.
Hi, Dave. It's Carrie Finney.
Please, go ahead.
I'm in my car and it's not muted, so you might hear some background noise. When I read the sentence about, and you just talked about it, your body only has two systems that have memory. Can you say more about that?
Well, the nervous and the immune, the central nervous system and the immune system have memory. And that's how we get inoculations and have a viral infection and never have it again, or, you know, how we can be inoculated for different you know, things that we get shots for. And none of the other systems have memory like that. So that's why in these two systems, the psychoneuroimmunological system, the combination of the nervous and the immune, are so powerful and so interactive. And when we consider energy into these two systems, the energy is in synchrony, and anything that depletes one is going to deplete the other. Think about a time that you've been under stress, and the kind of stress is even very specific for the particular kind of weakening of the immune system, that a time of stress for you may result in, you know, 4 to 6 days later you get a cold. There may be other kinds of time periods. Sometimes it's 2 to 3 years for certain kinds of cancer. But the stress that depletes the immune system is also the same stress that depletes the nervous system, and vice versa. So these two are powerful systems in combination.
Helps. What I was also wondering about is like muscle memory. What about muscle memory?
Well, muscle memory, we're going to be talking about that. Muscle memory doesn't really reside in the muscle, but it resides in the brain, because that's procedural memory. It's one of the kinds of memories we have. We have explicit memory, like you can remember facts or dates,
right,
or things that are factual. But when we have a procedural memory, we have a memory of an experience that is more complex, like an attachment pattern, like riding a bicycle, things that once we have these experiences down, you cannot ride a bicycle for years and get on a bike and immediately know. That's the procedural memory, the memory of a procedure or of a process. And that's the kind of memory that I'm talking about when we have behavior or attachment patterns that manifest in relationships, not as specific memories, but become a kind of procedural memory that manifests as they come alive in a relationship. And this is where it's so powerful in coaching, because consider someone who has an attachment pattern that may not be working or may be sabotaging their success, and they're referred to you. And this person, for example, has alienated everybody in the executive suite, and it's a toss-up about are they going to get fired or is the person going to quit, because it's mutual. So you have the only possibility in that person's life of really doing something that is going to significantly help them change, because when they come to you and they start talking about things, guess what? They're going to be living out this same attachment pattern, and they're going to alienate you. But by checking your ego at the door, by putting your ego in a blind trust, by not taking it personally, you're able to build an alliance with someone and then to look together at this kind of attachment pattern and the kinds of issues that get in the way of someone interacting with other people that has been there for a lifetime that may not even be, but maybe in the periphery of someone's awareness. I mean, they may be able to say, yeah, I do annoying things, or I tend to do this in a relationship, but they don't exactly know how to create a purchase of it and to actually create a different story. Does that address your question a little bit better?
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, and that's something really important that we're going to come back to, because the ways we remember and recreate are the ways we are. So that's especially important to understand in terms of how our minds and brains work. And that really is a key difference of working in this way with clients. When you really understand how someone's minds and how their brains work and how that can translate into behavior changes and behaviors that last, that's a huge difference. That's going to pre-select you to be in a very rare group of coaches, of professionals, period, because I think it can make such a huge difference and be so powerful. And we're going to talk more specifically about this and how to think about it and how to apply it.
Great.
Yeah. We have just a minute or two. Other thoughts or questions or things that you'd like us to talk about? I know we moved quickly through the first three steps. Does this make sense to you in terms of really understanding these ways of looking at one story and especially at your story?
Does for me.
Okay. And hopefully as you go through this, to do the exercises, it'll bring some things alive, crystallize some issues. It'll also give you an idea of if there are certain exercises that you might find useful with certain clients. It may not be the same for each client, but to see what might be useful to you and what you'd want to use to facilitate an aspect of your coaching work. Well, thank you all very much, and again, if there are questions or things that you'd like us to talk about, email me or jot them down, and we'll begin right here and look at that next time. So thanks very much, and have a great rest of the week.